Episode 341 of the podcast. I could explain how we got this guy on and it still wouldn't make sense. Bill Perkins joins the show today and he's got more money than God himself. More successful than the three of us on this podcast will ever be. Plays poker with billionaires, hangs out with Dan Bilzerian, runs a hedge fund, and happens to be a Hawkeye. Let's have a day. Let's go.
Walk-ons fans, episode 341 of the podcast, and today is probably the coolest day that we've had yet. Kluver and I were unbelievably giddy waiting to record this podcast because we have a guest on that we really never expected to be able to have a conversation with. This is a guy who is a former Hawk, always a Hawk, former Hawk football player just like us, and somebody who has been wildly successful in all of his other life endeavors. A guy I've been a fan of leading all the way back to like 2013 on high stakes poker. I'm a big poker nerd. I've been watching this guy battle it out with the legends of the poker world in the highest stakes for years and years. Chills with Dan Bilzerian. Pretty sure owns a yacht if I've seen his Instagram correctly. Venture capitalist, Iowa legend, Bill Perkins. Welcome to the Wash Up Walk-Ons and thank you so much for being here, man.
Thank you. Thank you. It's weird to hear my name like a legend, but you know, I'm having fun. I'm winging life and I'm having fun. So I can talk about it on how I got there and you know, how luck and work and you know, circumstances got me there.
Bill, if you're winging it, yeah, you got to be happy with how that turned out, man.
Yeah,
I forgot to add award-winning author to that intro.
Yeah, that was. I'm actually pretty proud about that because I wrote the book to save my life, like to try and like get the most out of my life, and then reason that other people would get value out of it. And you know, the feedback has been that people are getting value out of it, shifting their way of thinking, and you know, living more fulfilling lives. And so I'm really happy about that one.
How cool of a feeling is that to know that you're adding fulfillment to countless people's lives?
It's amazing. It's the best feeling. Like people reach out, I get random, you know, I can't respond to all of them, random DMs. Like I'm doing this because I read your book. You changed my view on Twitter. I'll see other authors who are financial experts. Like this is the first book that, you know, kind of changed my thinking. Mr. Money Mustache. I don't know if you know him, but he's a fire guy, financial independence, retire early. Yep. They're all about save, 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 save. He said he changed my mind about, you know, the allocation. When do I spend money and when do I do bigger things and bolder things earlier? So it's really good to like, kind of see something wrong, write about it, you know, and not write about it. Like, I want to be right. I want to like, hey, you guys can live a better life. You can have a more fulfilling life. Put it out there and people go, you know what? You're right. And thank you. So that's an awesome feeling. You know, it's a real awesome feeling. Like, I think when I was younger, just to add to that, you know, people ask you, you know, what's your fantasy? You know, and when you're like 17, it's like the girls. You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
I want to be a football star and I want an interception return for a touchdown and the girls, right? Like,
is your name Drake Kulik or are we just like the same guy here?
You know, but my two fears, my greatest fear and my greatest fantasy, they're the exact opposite. Like, my greatest fear is to accidentally take a life. Like, I'm so paranoid of like getting in an accident and like killing somebody or something like that. Like, I don't know how to live with that. And then my greatest fantasy is actually to save a life, to actually save somebody's life. And so when I wrote the book and when I was thinking about it, I was like, listen, if somebody's like not living their life to their fullest and you like change that, you actually save their life. You actually give them a piece of their life back because,
heck yeah.
You know, if somebody's drowning and you pull them out of a pool, guess what? You know, they're still going to die, right? They're still going to die. They're just not going to die that day. right?
Yeah.
So you gave them more hours of their life, right? And so if I write a book about getting your time back and living your life to your fullest, I'm giving you more life, more experiences, more things you get to have. So I feel very good about that.
Are you somebody who...
Go ahead.
I love that. Are you somebody, and this is probably a dumb question, but seems like from what you've done, you are someone who also fears not maximizing your potential?
Yeah, I have a lot of people fear running out of money. And I really fear like wasting my life.
Yes.
Right. Like I there are times, you know, I slacked a lot. I was a big slacker in high school, college, right? Like
I was going to say when you were like 10, because
I didn't really turn it on until life was like, oh, you're going to be broke and busted and not like it. And I was like, okay, I got to go through the pain to get to the promised land. Right. But I look back at those periods and I'm like, wow, I really didn't apply myself. I really didn't get the most I could out of it. And it was just me, right? It wasn't like these circumstances put me. It was really like I didn't take advantage of whatever I had at the time, right? I didn't to get what I wanted, right? Not to do what somebody else wanted, but just to get what I wanted. I didn't do the most that I could. Mm-hmm. And that could be altruistic, that could be hedonistic, right? Like it could be anything. Like, and so like when I look at each period, like, you know, the college period, the first job period, the you're married, small kids, et cetera. I'm like, okay, you know, as I started to become more aware of like this complete journey to the grave, right? Because we're all going to the same destination, right? It was like, what do I want to have and when? And how do I behave or what do I do to get the maximum out of it? Because I hate looking back to like, shit, in my 20s, I should have went to the club more. Or I should have done this more. I should have worked harder in the first job. I'd be promoted by now or whatever the circumstances are. And there are millions of circumstances for people in different scenarios. But it was like, I really want to optimize that period and the totality of my life. So when I'm on the grave, I'm like, man, that ride was fucking rough, man. I really rode the shit out of life and I had a great ride. I don't have regrets, you know?
I'm so with that. I want to be exhausted.
I'm big sold on that.
Yeah.
Living the coolest, most experience filled life so that once you can't really do that many things, you have all those experiences to just enjoy in your later years.
Right. And it's not just all, you know, a lot of people immediately go to like jets and yachts and poker and stuff. It's sometimes it's just like, wow, I wish I said I love you more to my mom when she was alive. I wish I went on walks with my daughter or whatever. It could be any of those things. I just want to make sure that I get the most out of it that I possibly can as a human, given that, you know, we make mistakes and have flaws, you know?
Yeah. I know Drake relates with that hard.
Big time.
Your dad go to Iowa?
Yeah. He's the real football legend. He went to Iowa. He was there from, I believe, 57 to 61. He was a scholarship player, had no real intention of going to college, like didn't know it, but like he saw kids playing football in high school and he's like, oh, I want to go play that. Coach was like, you know how to play football. And he's like, I know how to hit people. And it looks like,
yeah.
So they gave him some raggedy, uniforms, put them on there. And then the next day he had new uniforms and got a scholarship to go to Iowa, majored in Russian. And then played like back in the leather helmet days before there was like the NFL, like the leagues, you know, for the Dallas and then the Jets, and then went to Seton Hall Law. And so.
Yeah. I saw somewhere he knew like six languages.
I would say it wasn't six, but he definitely knew Spanish, English, and Russian. I don't know. Those are the three major. He was
I'll
Russian.
I'll tell you what, that's a big.
Which is weird Russian to have country. Like this like black dad who spoke Russian. And like, and I kept asking, I was like, were you a spy? Like, what the hell were you doing in Moscow? Like this friends of Moscow. This sounds like a front, but I can never. I guess he wasn't, but you know, I can never, you know, it wasn't like he explained anything else other than he spoke Russian and they had this hour. He didn't explain the thing or whatever, but. You know, he spoke Russian. He was
Guess he wasn't, but maybe he was.
I would never put it past me, like, you know, years later to this like declassify. Yeah, he was an operative for something. You know what I mean?
So you ended up, you found yourself to Iowa City. Somehow, some way you followed in the footsteps.
You know, I kind of like, it was really just like my dad had gone back to Iowa to visit with the Iowa Black Alumni Association. Remember, I'm a slacker. These are my slacker years. And I was just kind of like default. Like, I want to go to Iowa. I want to play football too. right? Okay. Like, I want to walk on, play football, be a star, right? You know, and at the time, like, my physical ability, I broke my leg at the growth plate in junior year. And so, like, my speed, whatever, is like, I was, I guess if I worked as hard as I should have, I could have been there. There were some great walk-ons. Phil Bradley, actually, he did score a touchdown on a block, right? He was a walk-on in my class. You know, I was in a class with Quinn Early. Quinn Early was before me, Mike Titley, a bunch of guys, Merton Hanks. I was, you know, in that area coming through. But I, you know, I still had that not take advantage of what was given to me type of attitude, like kind of like almost like a, like, I deserve this instead I need to work for it phase, you know? So I didn't fully take advantage of it. And I was in the College of Engineering and I was like slacking there too. So that was like, it was a bad scenario for me. Not that it was a bad experience. Like, I was having too much fun, right? In college, way too much fun and not enough work, both in football and College of Engineering, right? And then by my last year, I was like, I'm going to spend 4.5 years here and not have a degree if I don't like get my shit together, at least barely graduate, you know? And I did, and, you know, I eventually did, right? Graduate. And I went on to be like, you know, started off as like a peon, as a screen clerk in the New York Mercantile Exchange, you know? And that's when I was really like, okay, it's time to shine. It's time to, you know, put up, stop talking shit and actually do it. You know?
Yeah. Kluver and I were extremely, extremely interested to hear how you went from the electrical engineering degree at Iowa to energy exchange.
Yeah. So I really, you know, when they have career day, you know, they would have people from IBM come in and talk about engineering. And I really didn't want to do that. It was really not satisfying to me that kind of, the life where it's kind of like planned out, right? Like,
yes,
you come in, you're like junior chip a year, you get a promote. And after 5 years, you get whatever. And then you work, you know, and you work on a subsection of a chip and your specialty, and it's part of a big thing. And that's great. That's why we have great products, right? There's one guy who's working on this, just like the communication of one chip area to the other area and making it faster. But like, to me, that was death, right?
Death in a cubicle type deal.
Yeah. It was just kind of like, that's that kind of life. And, you know, I was pretty delusional. And I tell people, I'm like, I was delusional, but my delusions came true. You know, I was like, I want to be rich and I can make whatever. And, you know, at the time there was a lot of movies called, you know, there was a movie called Wall Street that was out, and not being the greedy, you know, criminal guy, but like noticing that these stockbrokers, like, they'd seem like they made infinite money and they were able to do whatever they want. And so I got a job as a screen clerk, like literally a peon, like working in a mailroom is the equivalent, right? And kind of worked my way up in that way, you know. So the reason I did it, the reason I went to that is I just saw the leverage that they had and their ability to make a lot of capital, right? In order to have the life they really wanted. Right. And so back then, you know, when I was formal, I was like, you know, a lot of people just work. They're not like, I mean, I think if everybody could do exactly what they wanted at a certain year, like, we'd all be actors or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, some of us would be brain surgeons, whatever, but there would be too many actors, right? Yeah, there would be too many actors, too many people doing commercials and movie stars, right? Everybody be a movie star or a rock star, right?
A lot of drug addicts.
So yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, by and large, most people do something that they're good at or competent at or something in order to acquire capital to do the things they really want to do. Right.
Like, yeah, that's the purpose, that slave, right? To your job type.
Right. Like, it's a means to an end. Right. And, oh, you know, part of that end is, you know, I want a house over my head. I want to be able to eat and drink. But after that, it's all the other things you want. Right. Which are as varied as there are people. And so I was like, okay, but I want a lot of different things and I don't want to have to ask the price tag. And I want, you know what I mean? I want the means that the lifestyle that I was solving for was, you know, much larger and required a lot of cash. And so I was like, okay, this field, this area, right? And it kind of fit because it seemed like you know, you do apply logic, you do apply reasoning, you do apply, you know, math, and, you know, you have a logical way of thinking coming through engineering and math backgrounds, and those type of puzzles, right, I'm pretty good at. Right. So I went into an area where, like, you know what I mean? Like, I at least I thought I was good. Like, I was arrogant enough to think I can solve this puzzle better than, you know, the average person. And, you know, I kind of journeyman my way on different sides of the industry, from, you know, a screen clerk working up to, like, you know, a phone clerk on the exchange to over-the-counter broker, which I didn't like. And people are like, well, what's the difference between a broker and a trader? And I was like, well, imagine there's a person who buys and sells houses, and then there's a real estate agent. I wanted to be the person who buys and sells houses, right? Not the real estate agent, because I, you know, my personality is like, I'm very, people are going to be shocked, but I'm very introverted, right? Like, I'm a very small circle, right? I like to be dependent on my own efforts, not whether that person likes me or not. You know what I mean? If you're a real estate broker and people don't like you, or they you know, they got their own other friend they want to talk to, or their cousin's a real estate broker, you don't get the deal, right? Yeah. If you're a trader, it's just your brains. Did you make the right decision to buy the right house and sell the right house at the right time, yeah, right? And so that's the side I wanted to be on. I got that opportunity, and, you know, long story short, so I don't blather anybody, I've been fairly successful at it.
you said the words delusional, you said introverted, you like to just bet on yourself, small circle. These are things that I've heard from people who are very successful, where they just have ultra confidence in themselves to get things done.
Yeah. I you know, I don't want to confuse people or like kind of paint this picture like, if you believe in yourself, it will happen, but it is a requirement. Right. It is a prerequisite, yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. Like, if you want to hit a home run, you have to show up at the plate. Right. Yeah. And in the plate of life, like, many people will be like, well, I don't want to go out there in front of 55,000 people and strike out.
Sure.
Right. I'm going to look like an idiot. My mom's going to be like, what are you doing? And your girlfriend's going to be like, I told you so. And internally, like, we're our own worst critics, right? Like,
they're afraid of the accountability, right?
Yes, you're afraid of accountability, but we're also afraid of the shame or failure of failing, right? And lucky for me that I'm clownish enough, like, I really don't give a shit what a lot of people think. Like, my give a shit meter is on the lower side, right? We all give some, you know, unless you're a complete sociopath, you give some shits, right? Like, but like, there's a bell curve, right? There's people like, oh, I can't, you know, what are they gonna think, you know, like, whatever. Like, when you're teenage years, like, you're always thinking everybody's watching you and they care, yes, you know. And then as you get older, you're like, people don't really give a shit what I'm doing. Like, they're just moving on in their own lives, right?
Yeah.
I'm kind of on the far end of the spectrum. Like, I'm willing to look like a complete fool.
You're talking to two guys who are exactly
and like, I'm willing to have people go like, can you believe Bill Perkins tried that shit and he failed? Like, what a dumb fuck, right? Like, and so,
hey, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Exactly.
Bill.
But I'm
another very successful man said that.
Swinging. Yeah, exactly. And that's what got me to the plate, swinging, you know, swinging away, right? Thinking that I'm going to hit a home run, and, you know, I hit a home run, right?
You hit a couple. We're going to get back to the podcast with Bill Perkins. What a legend, honestly, in just a second. And honestly, missed opportunity. You'll hear that not once in this entire podcast do we ask Bill to sponsor us, which probably was a miss. Nonetheless, he'd have to wait to sponsor us anyway, because the title sponsor of this show, the ones who keep us alive, the boys and girls at DRF Sports, wonderful people. I got to meet with them, cut the ribbon on the sports book in Osceola at Lakeside Hotel and Casino. I'm going back and forth with them on a weekly basis, talking about stuff for the podcast. I'm about to be at the Iowa State Fair a couple times, maybe, at the DRF booth. And they're running promotions all the time. Boost in your profits. Boost. I have to say that word so many times when I cut ads for them. Boost. And I don't say it well. But they're able to boost your profits through analysis, statistics, education, all based around their sports betting app. You can do a whole lot in there. It's very easy. It's very simple, user-friendly, and they are the Iowa Sportsbook. They are the Walk-On Sportsbook. DRF Sports. Go to ia.drf.com and join into the fun today. Also want to take a moment to shout out the boys at AdCraft. We have a store that is open as of you listening to this episode. If you listen from the day it's out through a week past this date, there is a store open right now. Now, if you're listening a couple years down the road, which is very possible because this is going to be a popular episode, you may not get to participate in this limited time store, but we will be running stores 3 to 4 times a year where you can get limited edition, limited time merchandise. And we also have a 24/7 store that's open all the time that we are constantly trying to build our inventory in. Most of our popular stuff, the Walk-On shirt, the original Hawks by a Million, the Block Hawks by a Million, all of those plus the flags are stocked in that store. And both our limited time stores and our 24/7 stores are all done by AdCraft. So not only have they taken over and printed our merchandise, come up with the designs in combination with us, incredible art team, incredible customer service. They do things on light speed, but they also have provided us a platform to basically open up an online store. They are making us money and they are incredible for it. Colin, one of the guys over there, the main guy that I'm in contact with, has been a delight to work with since the beginning. And if you guys have any custom merchandise ideas that you want to sell or get into or pump out to an organization, a workplace, a softball team, whatever it may be, go to the guys at AdCraft. Prices are insane, insanely good, all that. AdCraft. Now, back to the show. Is there anything from your childhood, your upbringing, maybe something, a way that your parents parented you that instilled that sort of belief and ability to step up to the plate?
You know, it's very hard to self-analyze. But one of the things I've been recently telling people, and I think this is common amongst, so I was born in 1969, right? And I just tweeted, like, my mom was pregnant with me in 1968. This is a year that, like, Martin Luther King was shot. There were riots going on. You know, there was, you know, all kinds of, you know, there were laws against Black people, blah, blah, blah. Right. And I grew up like right kind of after that period where, you know, the racism and the racial tension and people talking about you was like palpable. You were aware of it, right? Mm-hmm. Like there were no Black people on TV until it was like Good Times or something. You know what I mean? Like there was there was that period. And so I'm not saying that to be like, right on. The benefit of that is that you were talked about and you knew it wasn't true. You were stereotyped and you knew it wasn't true. You had this all the time, right? Like this kind of background of these people talked about you, et cetera. And, you know, associating you with putting you in this box, right? And you just don't give a shit. Like you are trained not to give a shit, right? Like you're like, they think this anyway. So what does it matter?
Yep.
Right. So that kind of training kind of gives you that, like, I don't care what yep. these people think. They think bullshit all the time. Whereas if I had a pristine record or whatever, you know, like if I didn't have that training, I'd be like, oh, I don't want to ruin this thing because I'm going to ruin my rep. You know what I mean? Like, I have no rep, you know? Yeah. I think that was helpful. And I don't think you're going to get that period nowadays. I don't think my children are going to get the same kind of like treatment because, you know, as time goes forward and culture changes, right? Like, you know, the world, despite the media and what's going on, the world is less racist than it was in 1968. It's way less racist than when my parents were teenagers, right? Like, yeah. You know, like, you know, et cetera. So like, and 70s, right? In the 70s and 80s. And so that was one part of the training. And also my dad, you know, having, you know, he's a kid of like 39, right? So imagine the 40s and 50s, imagine his level, I don't give a shit, yeah. right? And his battles, right? So he was like, and he was a badass and he, you know, in college, went to college, went to law school, spoke Russian. Like he was like, you know, there's, he would be like, he said this to me constantly. I'm glad you asked this question because I didn't remember this until now. Like I didn't remember this till now. He used to tell me, there's who you say you are, there's who people say you are, and there's who you really are.
Yeah.
He used to say that to me all the time, right? And so, and what he was like, what really matters is who you really are, right? So, because like you sometimes like, oh, I'm this or that, and you're just talking shit, right? That's not really you. You know what I mean? Like you're saying you're doing these things, but you're not really being accountable. And you're not being, and there's the things other people say. It's like who you really are, and that's what matters, right? So, you know, it's kind of like you need to do the thing, right? And then that's going to define who you are and what you do. And so that kind of that statement plus the training, I think, is what gives me that extra willingness to like, you know, hey, you said you don't want to waste your life during this period. You don't want to be afraid. Then go ahead and do it. Go ahead and start the business. Go ahead and tell the girl I love you. Go ahead and, you know, take your shot. You know,
I love it.
So
before we get into your adult life past college, I want to ask if you remember any days of Iowa football where like that specifically stick out in your mind, conditioning, summer.
Oh yeah. 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 The main thing that was, is that like, let me tell you the slacker. So, you know how at the, you guys, I think they still do this. Like you come back after summer and you got to run, like, it's not a steeplechase, but you got to do this in shape thing where you got to run back and forth, tag the thing,
sure,
whatever. And I'd always come back out of fucking shape. And so, and I remember, and so you used to have to run extra sprints after practice.
Hey, right? Bill, I've been there, man.
You just have to run extra sprints of practice until you made your time, right? It was like the DBs had their time, the running backs had their time, and you'd have to run back and forth and tag it. I never made, you know, I'd come back like, what were you doing all summer? You know, like that type of guy, like you were supposed to do this, 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 this. And so I remember running extra sprints all the time after practice. And I remember, you know, me and myself and Mike Titley having to go run and complete our time. And you had to keep doing it until you made your time. Right. And so I was like, you know, people talk about Shaquille O'Neal, how like he uses a season to get in shape. I was like, that was me, you know, that was me. Like in practice, it was brutal.
When we were in college, Bill, they called that fat camp. And if you weighed in over what you were supposed to, you had to run the extra sprints at the end of practice and you had to be on Breakfast Club to make sure that they were monitoring your meals and you weren't eating a bunch of extra dumb calories and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one thing. That's one thing, particular experience. It was just kind of like, you know, it reminded me of my high school geometry and algebra 2 teacher used to say, you always got to pay the price. You got to pay the price, which I think is you know, you have to pay the price. And I had to pay the price. I paid the price eventually, you know, like,
yeah. The, you leave Iowa, you get the job, you start working your way up. When do you feel like you first catch like your first big break? You feel like, oh shit, like I'm starting to do something.
You know, I was a screen clerk and I was like, okay, I'm going to redefine what it means to be a screen clerk. I'm not going to, like, there's a error rate that they have checking trades and stuff like that. I'm like, I'm not going to have that. I'm not going to be socializing, goofing off with the people that are just goofing off that want to be career screen clerks. I'm going to go on. And I quickly was making no money to making like 30 grand a year and then 36. And I remember I was like, I make more than my mother. You know what I mean? Like that's what I thought. You know, when that's what I was like, I am a ball. You know what I mean? Like I after all the struggling and making no money, whatever, and it was like happening, you know, fairly quickly. And I was just like, I make more than my mom. I'm a badass. And like literally, like I have not felt like more on top of the world than to the day I was like, I realized I made more than my mom down in New York City. They think the ferry, you know, I can. The ferry was more expensive than the train. Now there's ferries going back and forth from Manhattan and New Jersey all the time. But I used to, you know, then could afford to take the ferry up top. And it was very empowering to like come in and see Manhattan, this was back when the two Twin Towers were there, at World Trade Center. And just, you know, it was just like, this is my city. I'm making it, you know, I'm Joe $36,000 a year guy now, you know, and I just felt like a king. And it was really just the rate of change in my life. you know, it was a rapid rate of change going from like, wow, I have no money. I'm driving a limo at night to make ends meet to like, I make more than my mom. Like, yeah, take that, mom. You know what I mean? Like,
you were driving a limo.
Yeah. Well, so, when I was making like, I think it was like $16,000 a year, somewhere around that, the exact number, but it wasn't enough money to like really
live.
It was like no money, you know, like you start with
Uber
no
wasn't a thing yet. So.
Yeah. And so my boss at the time, the limo driver quit. They're like, we need some, I heard them talking. I was like, I'll drive the limo. Like I need the money. Like I will drive the limo. And actually, if I was just a limo driver, I would have made a lot more money than I was making at the time because one, it paid pretty good at the night, right? At night. And two, these guys would get drunk and tip like mad, you know? And I would be like, this is amazing. Like, you know, and I was saving my money, you know, just super frugal and just, you know, like trying to, you know, make ends meet at the time and like have a life and be able to go on a date and not sweat the popcorn, you know, that type of thing. So, I was,
you got rapidly, to the point, you got to the point in life where you don't sweat a $12 popcorn.
Yeah.
I'm a long way from that, Bill.
Yeah, long way. Like sweating the popcorn was a thing. Like I was sweating bullets, you know, and it's fun being young and in New York City or whatever, but being busted is definitely a crimp on your social life. In New York City, you know, there's lots of other busted people and girls, whatever, but it's just hard to mix in there at the level I wanted to mix seeing the other people. So I was really, really, really happy, you know, that period when I was like, I make more than my mom. I can do some things, you know, shortly after that I was making double, triple that, you know, five times that, but that I specifically remember that.
That's amazing. Correct me if I'm wrong, you're 27, 28, and you start Small Ventures USA in 1997.
Yeah. So I came down, I was making good money. Now I'm trading in Houston. Just having fun learning and doing what I at the time liked and loved, a puzzle I liked and loved that was potentially extremely lucrative, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I have other ideas or other ventures or things I want to do. And originally it was like, it's this holding company. But the first thing I was doing was like, oh, I'm going to do real estate flipping. This thing is huge. And I actually did go to like, you know, every Tuesday in Houston, they do the tax auctions and liens. And I bought one house, flipped it. I did the tax things and, you know, was out there in the streets. But I quickly was like, you know what? This sucks. Not because it didn't pay. And I highly recommend it to other people that want to go do the work and get it. But I was like, I don't want to do the work. It's like real work.
Yeah.
You know, when you're trading, it's like my brain and computers and solving the puzzle. It's like really going down to the auction house, pulling out the sheets, doing the so-and-so, bidding the house, get the house, whatever, et cetera. It's great returns. And, you know, you need people that get back to have a lot of capital. And it's like almost free money. The tax lien stuff. It literally is almost free money. Yeah. But it was real work. And, you know, I wanted the most leveraged type of situations as possible. And that wasn't it because I had to go do real work.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like real, real hard work. Like, I mean, it was, but it took a lot of time. Like, you know, you would go look at the houses, you'd have to go through the houses, you'd miss things that you worked, you know, you'd work a week or hours figuring out, you go down, somebody bids higher than you, takes it, you're like, crap, you know? But, you know, those guys, those people, individuals even, they're making a pretty damn good living doing that.
Yeah.
You know,
it is a lot of work.
But it's not for you. And
it wasn't for me, but I'm like, it's a different field.
But then you become your own boss.
Yeah. I become my own boss. I set up the company and now I have this holding company that I can do other ventures and put other things under the Small Ventures umbrella. Mm-hmm. Right. And so as I became more and more wealthy, it became the, holding place, for other ventures that I would put in there. Right.
Did you feel like at this point, you unlocked life a little bit and you started to like, did you ever have the dissociation of like, oh, I've, you know, you see these people keeping up with the Joneses you know, they wake up, they drive to work, they run their 9 to 5. It's like they hate their life. And at some point did you realize I'm playing my own game here? Like, this is awesome.
Yeah. Yes and no. I mean, I knew I didn't want to do this kind of like define career path, picket fence life. Right. Yeah. But I was still on autopilot and just like, I was doing what I thought rich guys could supposed to do that were marketed to me, but okay. That wasn't organic in who I was.
Okay.
Right. Like, I remember when I would like, bought the car and I was like, I don't even like cars. I'm not a car guy. Like, you know, when I was a kid, yes, I had Matchbox cars and I like cars, but like, I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to buy the fucking car, the fancy car. And then I got like the car and I didn't like it.
What was the car?
I had a Lamborghini. I had a McLaren. This is later on in life. I had these cars and I didn't, you know, it's like, I didn't know what I wanted. I only knew what was marketed to me.
Yep.
Like when you go to the movie, they have the stereotypical rich guy. This is what they do. Right. Yep. And I was like, okay, now I'm rich. Like I should do this.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, when I look back to that period, now I'm like, wow, fuck, why didn't I do this, this, and this? I could have done it right. You know what I mean? I could have traveled here. I could have done this exploration. I could have afforded this. I could have X, Y, and Z. Had I really like sat down and thought about it, and I would have had a better, richer, and I don't mean richer like money. I mean, richer experience for that period. Not saying I didn't have fun. I'm not saying I didn't have fun. I'm just saying like it wasn't optimized.
Yeah. The Lambo and the McLaren, they still went fast, right? It was still.
They still went fast, but it was just kind of like this kind of like typical, it was a cliche movie, rich guy life, not like a real rich life that I wanted to have. Right.
But you can only learn that lesson organically because not a lot of people actually get to that status where they can just buy a McLaren because they want to. And it takes that experience to know that, that doesn't really fulfill me. These other things.
But I knew I wasn't a car guy. What I didn't do is sit down and think like, okay, what do you really want to have? Like you're in your 20s, you're single, you have money. What experiences do you want to have before you get married and you have a kid and blah, blah, blah. Like, what does your life look like? What adventures do you have? I didn't have that conversation with myself over time to really then go, okay, how do I execute on this plan now? Let me execute on this. Who do I need? What coaching do I need to do this, right? I wanted older Bill to come in at a time and be like, idiot. You know what I mean? Like, go do this, go visit, go live in this, Spain for the summer, go back, you know, go here, go do this, go get your friends, scholarship them and go on your adventure and do these things that you're not going to be able to do later in the way that you can do it now.
Oh yeah. I was just going to ask, what is older Bill realize now? What are those things? Traveling?
Yeah. I think I like the way you travel, at my age versus the way you travel as younger, it's different. And in a lot of ways, I think it's a richer experience. Mm. Like my brother, he's like a perpetual student. Like he was backpacking all through Asia. He was in Australia. He was doing all these things. Right. And he's like the expert on youth hostels around the world. Right. Like he'll tell you like, that one's a terrible youth hostel. This is one of the greatest youth hostels in so-and-so, right? Like, and it's kind of, you talk to him, you look, I, you know, my family's like, your brother's freaking crazy. And I told him, I said, listen, I think you're doing life better than me. You know, you have the most rich experiences, the adventures, like the enjoyment, like you have some, you know, just some of the greatest stories. And he, you know, you can tell when he tells a story like, oh yeah, I was in Indonesia and I stayed at this hotel and I met these people and this led to this and this and that. You're like, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm like, fuck, I want that story. You know, like I want your life, you know? And so, you know, I didn't do that. Right. I led more of a, not completely, but a more plasticky cliche type rich guy life. In that time period. Right.
Yeah.
So was that kind of a little bit of the inspiration for your Die With Zero book, your brother's life versus yours?
No, I mean, it was just those observations, right? I mean, it was when I was in New York City earlier, this is before I was really rich, but just getting to the point where like I make more money than my mom.
Yeah.
I was wondering like, okay, you know, everybody says I want to have $1 million before X, right? It's never before 80, right? Nobody says, I hope I'm a millionaire before 80,
right?
Or 50 even, right? They might if they're 45, but generally, like if you're in your 20s, nobody said, you know, or 19, 20, I'm like, I want to be a millionaire before 30, right? Is a common saying, right? And there's a reason for that, right? Inherent in that is like, why not before 60, right? Because your ability to do things and experience life, right, changes as you age. And I was thinking, well, what are the experiences people want to have? Like, why did they say that, you know? And so, you know, I was like, what is there? And so like in New York City, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a multimillionaire, but they're generally old. And when I was younger, I was kind of like, add it to old, who cares? You know, they were my age now, right? Like they're in their 40s, right? I was like, life is passing them by, right? Like an idiot. But one of the things I was latching onto is that what is it all for and what do I want, right? What is the purpose and why is it important that I have the money before 40 or before 30, right? And, you know, I was thinking about like connecting the dots, like experiences, right? And even though I was thinking about it, I wasn't completely there. I wasn't having a visceral understanding. I was still doing the cliche ride, right? That was kind of just basically marketed to you, right? In movies, TVs, culture, et cetera. And not really thinking about really what do I want out of life and what is this money for, right?
Yeah.
Like after I got food, shelter, clothes, like after that's done, like, okay, what else is it for?
Yeah.
Right.
You got ripped up recently.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. The funny thing is I was like, I'm writing this book. Well, during the pandemic, especially at the beginning, I was like, oh, it's like a 5 to 20% chance I'm going to die in the next 3 years. This is in the beginning, right? When nobody knew anything, right? Like, they were showing videos of people in Italy and I was just like, of course where I'm going to get it. And I'm this age, right? Like I'm going to die. So the long-term disappeared. And I was like eating like a prisoner on death row while we were in lockdown in St. Thomas. And then, you know, looked at the data. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to die. But the habits had set in, right? I was still eating like a prisoner on death row, right? Like there's no death row, son. I'm still have these cookies, you know, et cetera. And I was going to get married. And I was like, I wrote a book about how, you know, the interplay of your wealth, your health, and your time. And here I am, fat as fuck. You know what I mean? Like with these habits. And I'm like, I need to get in shape because like, you know, the biggest determinant, the biggest variable on your fulfillment at any moment in time is your health. Right. And so if you want to maximize your experiences, you want to maximize your fulfillment on this planet, you want to be in, you know, your maximum shape as close as possible.
We've been trying to preach that on this podcast for a long time, man. That's how Kluver makes his living.
Yeah.
Is by trying to instill that thought process.
Yeah. In people. Yeah. So that was the first reason. And, you know, I want to look good when I have sex too, just like everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you're on the yacht, you got to look good.
Yeah. I was just talking to a friend. I was like, yeah, let's go work out. Let's go lift. I'm like, I'm in shape. I did my cardio, whatever. He's like, let's go work. I was like, listen, you work out. How much is your working out is for vanity? He's like 100%. I'm like, well, mine is to stay in shape and live longer and have enjoyment experiences. Vanity. But I have that too. But, you know, so I was like, okay, what is max for me? Right. What can I do? And it was partly of a contest. I had a bet with Dan Bilzerian about could I get to sub 9% in 6 months from where I was, which was like 24. And let me tell you something. I knew I could do it, but it's just painful. It was very painful in a race, but you know, people don't have to race like me. The math is fairly simple, right? The math will take over, right? Yep. Like the same process that got me there on the way up, like overeating X calories per day is just simple math. I'm just start ballooning, right? And not working out. It works in reverse, you know, burn X more calories than you take in per day. It works in reverse. So you could do that over a year or you could do that, you know, in 3.5 months because Mr. Delay it to the end, you know, et cetera.
You got there.
Correct. You got there. It was very, very, very painful in a race format. But if I wasn't racing, it would be very easy. You know, it's just setting up the habits. The real, when people say, well, how do you do it? I was like, the real thing is set up the habits. Make it easy for you to succeed.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You made a similar bet with the Staples brothers.
Yeah. They did
them into a healthy lifestyle.
I've switched to body fat because, you know, you can lose weight and that's great, but like body fat percentage and getting rid of the visceral fat, not just like shedding muscle mass, you know, at the same time, I think is definitely better for people, right? Like you want to have the muscle mass on there. But it's your biggest determinant. And so I wrote the book to save my own life. And I was like, well, I need to listen to what the words I wrote in this book and get in shape. And obviously like the cliche is true. I feel so much better. It's great. You know what I mean? Everything is so much better.
What's the routine look like now that you're not in race mode, but just me?
Well, it's just, you know, I know what my RMR is, is like 2,500,
yep.
Like me just walking around is 2,500 calories a day. So like,
damn good.
Depending on where I am, I'm that's kind of like the average target where I'm going. You know, I do my cardio, keeping my cardio up and my muscles, you know, maintaining some muscle mass, et cetera. And so, you know, my trainer, we worked out, we only do 30 minutes of weights a day.
Yep.
Like when I go to the trainer and he's like, it's 30 minutes of weights. There's no breaks, right? It's circuit. So I call it 30 minutes of hell, but it's only 30 minutes. And I think everybody can do 30 minutes of hell.
Absolutely.
And then because of, you know, back and cartilage, I'm not an impact guy to my back. I just do the Peloton for cardio.
Love it. Love it.
And so, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to afford a Peloton and put it in my house. So it makes it easy. I don't have an excuse. It's not like, oh, it's raining, I'm not going to go to the gym, or, oh, blah, blah, blah. It's like, nah, motherfucker. It's right up there. You know, get on it.
But Hoover also bought a Peloton with our podcast money. So
yeah.
Yeah. We're actually trying to still recoup the funds from Hoover's Peloton.
Yeah. The idea that, you know, behavior, I learned this from, I took a boot camp on behavior design, and behavior is a convergence of motivation, ability, and a prompt. You know, a lot of people focus on the motivation. Like, you got to do it and I got to get you motivated, whatever, which is fine. But motivation goes up and down, right? Depending on what's going on, you got a stomach ache or whatever. You know, the technology companies always focus on ability or making it easy. Right. So easy to click the notification button, one click buying, one click this, potato chips all around you. Right. So, you know, a real good example is this, is that, you know, people will be on their phone all night, right, when they're trying to go to bed, and like, oh, I always get on my phone. Go ahead and put it in your bathroom. I guarantee you won't get up out of bed. Just that small change in difficulty changes the behavior. And so it works also with working out and other things, like make it easy for you to actually do the behavior that gets you to your goal. And so the Peloton in your house makes it a lot easier. So you're going to use it more, right? It's going to help you get to your goal, right? Walking with a friend 3 miles, that's going to make it easier because you got a friend and a buddy. Like whatever it is to make it easy helps, right?
You hear Bezos and all these guys, they all have their meditation, their whatever that makes them successful, right? Are there any other daily practices that Bill Perkins does that you think are really helpful for your productivity?
Wow. That's a good question. I don't know if it's,
if there isn't, then don't, you don't have to bullshit.
No. I'm going to approach it from a different way. It's not a productivity, but one of the things I think I do that people ask is like, I'm very curious and I stay very curious. I'm just constantly hoovering information.
It's a great training.
And which gives me what they call range. And occasionally I'm able to take that, apply it to that, and it makes me successful, right? Even in my own field, like I'm constantly hoovering information, looking at what could happen, what's going on, what's the approximate cause of the next move? You know, I'm super curious, right? And I'm curious in fields that I'm not even directly related to me, but then it's like, it becomes a thing. And they're like, how did you get in this? Well, I read the thing and the article and whatever. And then I clicked the link. And the next thing you know, I was in some research paper, reading a research paper, you know, from the link. You know, I'm one of those guys, like, you read the story, it's just like a summary kind of clicky news story. And then there's a link to the guy who was the professor or the researcher. And then I click that guy and then I read his paper. And then, you know, I just go down the rabbit hole. You know, I would say 90 something percent of the time, it's just entertainment, right? I'm just learning for entertainment. But the other 4% of the time, it gives me depth and understanding or something, a link that is profitable for my life.
Yeah, that's
awesome. Right? Or I'll apply a principle, right? Like I went to a behavior design class from taught by a Stanford professor, his boot camp, because I was trying to learn about which ad words are the most successful. And then so I happened upon this at the time when I was clicking the links, it was called the Stanford School of Persuasion. I was like, wait, what the fuck? They actually have a school of persuasion? Like they actually teach this in college, right? It's called behavior design now. And then I, you know, so I'm like, oh yeah, you know, these envelopes, you know, those are the things like this weird trick or seven ways to lose belly fat or whatever. Those little headlines are the things that wrap you into a thing. And I was looking at how does that work and what makes you successful. And then I clicked on Stanford and found BJ Fogg. And then I was reading up on his behavior design model. I was like, this is genius shit. Like I could really use this in everything, right? Everybody can use that. Your podcast can use that. And then next, you know, I'm like, oh, he wrote a book called Tiny Habits. And I was reading through and he's like, oh, he has this boot camp on behavior design. Then I signed up begged my way into the boot camp, got into the boot camp of behavior design. And now I use the things I was taught in that class in everything.
That's
awesome. And it enhances everything from my personal life, professional life, et cetera, behavior design. Actually, this bet that I won, beat Dan Bilzerian, behavior design. It was like, how do I design for success? You know?
Yeah. Curiosity. That's huge. I'm curious how you got to be friends with Dan Bilzerian.
This is weird. Like a lot of people. So obviously I met him originally through poker, right? At the poker tables. He used to play poker, but we really became close because I convinced him to go to an emotional intelligence class.
Wow.
In Las Vegas.
Wow.
I did not know him. And so I had gone to this EQ class called Choice in Nevada. You know, they've changed it, but like they're the way they market, like there's two ways you can market. And it's also kind of like a test. They call it it's very cult like the way the marketing goes, but you tell other people, hey, come in. This is the impact it had on my life.
Sure.
And how it changed my life. You know, I think you get a lot of value out of it. And, you know, I saw some things in Dan and I thought he would get a lot of value out of it. And he's like, I'll go. And I'm like, I'm serious. Like you got to go, but don't quit. He's like, I don't quit. I will go.
Wow.
So he went. So a lot of people think Dan Bilzerian, emotional intelligence class. I'm like, yeah,
that one doesn't line up.
It's a lot, it's a lot, you know, people are not one dimensional. Right. And obviously, you know, when you're snapping the highlights of different people's lives, like on Instagram, like his highlight is like hedonism and living a life he wants to live. Right.
Yeah, but yeah.
There's other aspects of it. Right. And so that's how Dan and I became close friends.
Drake, I know you're chomping at the bit.
What was it like to play high stakes poker, man? What is it like? I'm a poker player myself, and I made a living off that for a few years and really enjoyed it. So I'm just like super curious from a fanboy perspective.
It's fun. It's a little nerve wracking. As a matter of fact, like I would be in a, like, let's say I'm in a pot and it's like, I don't know, $80,000, which is, and I just made a bet. And I'm very, like, if you could put a heart monitor up, you hear my heart, cacao, cacao, cacao. Like, is he going to raise?
Too,
is
man.
Whatever, he's going to, whatever. Like, you're just like, oh my God, dude, like, what do I do if he does this? Like, even though the sum of money, like I make bigger risk reward decisions, et cetera, I'm kind of outside my area of expertise, right? Like these guys are like pros and I'm like, shit, I'm lost. You know, like, I don't know if I'm supposed to call, fold, raise, go all in, bluff, whatever. And you know, when you're not the pro, you find yourself in that situation. It's exhilarating. It's fun, but it's also a little nerve wracking because I'm not the expert. Like I don't have that. Like if I lose $1 million trading natural gas that day, it'd be like, that's how it goes. I know I did my best. I made the right decision. You know, I'm almost the house, right? Like,
right.
But in poker, when you, you know, each situation is almost like a test, right? Yeah. Every single thing is a test. Did I pass it? Did I test? Did I do the right behavior? Did I did it right there? And TV cameras on you and whatever. You're just like, fuck, I know I'm fucking this up. Fuck. You know, like, you know, like you find yourself in that scenario. You know, as time has gone on, I've, you know, I'm still like, you know, these guys are constantly playing, constantly sharpening a game and constantly being reminded. Like, I haven't played, actually September 9th, I'm going to go play poker on TV live.
Poker Go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Antonio Spandiari live. I think it's High Stakes Poker or Poker After Dark. It's one of the TV ones.
Cool.
We're going to go film. But I'm like, I haven't played in so long. I'm a little worried, but I'm like, ah, fuck it. You know, they're pros.
That's when you're going to do the best. Because
yeah, exactly.
You're come at them with a completely different game.
I'm going to come at them. We'll come at them to try and hurt people, you know? And so I enjoy it. There's, you know, poker is, to me, it's better than golf, because in golf, you got to be quiet. That guy's all the way over there and the weeds, et cetera. There, you know, you're all together. You can talk smack. You can talk about things. You learn about people. You meet interesting characters. Yeah. All types of people play poker. So that's enjoyable. That's enjoyable about High Stakes Poker and playing on TV. The being put to the test in front of the camera, you know, even though I'm on the don't give a shit, I'm just like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna look like such a clown. You know what I mean? You
that know, is tough. That
in
is
front
tough.
Of a TV audience is kind of like, yeah. Imagine you took the SATs and every time there was like a TV, we're like, well, is he gonna pick the right answer? You know, that type of thing. It's a little nerve wracking, right?
Some imposter syndrome in there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But you know, I'm not afraid to get up there and chop it up and have a good time.
Who are some of your favorites to play with?
Well, I like Phil just because he goes nuts. You know what I mean? If you beat him, like you can always like, it's like an added bonus. If you get him, you get the entertainment value. Rick Solomon, cause he's just unpredictable and puts a lot of pressure on people.
All time, you know, legendary human as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Antonio, just cause we like to mess with each other. We're friends, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Those guys are some of the best people to come.
That's a great lineup right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever found yourself sitting at the table and you're just like, fuck, I should not be here. Like I'm in way too deep. Like I got to get out of here.
Yeah. Like every cash game I play. No. I guess in the beginning, like I'm in the beginning, but I think as I've, you know, I've learned and then I kind of forgot. So I go get in there. I've gotten to a spot where I'm like not afraid to step in a ring with anybody, yeah. But there's times where I'm just like, I am lost. You know what I mean? Like I am lost. I'm taking a test that I didn't study for. And everybody's been there like, holy shit, we got a final today. You know,
like, that was me.
But they didn't have TV cameras in that final.
We got a final today. Holy shit. And a paper's due. And I didn't do it. And you're like, you got like an hour. Like I've been in that scenario. Like, you know how like after I graduated, like I used to have that nightmare of like, oh, there was a final and I didn't study like a thermodynamics class, which is like, oh my gosh, I have a thermodynamics test. I used to have that nightmare of a thermodynamics test that I didn't study for.
Yep. I still have that nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. So it lasts a while, you know,
You got back last year for the Penn State game. Is that correct?
I believe, was it Penn State? Well, they honored Mike Titley at the game.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And how often do you get back? I think Drake was talking about you were back in like,
can't remember.
Maybe it wasn't, but you've been back recently in the last few years, right? At least once.
Or yeah. Time. Yeah. I got back for a game. That was great. I went there for, I think it was Penn State. We honored Mike. Not as often as I like, you know, I've grown loathsome of the cold, you know? So like, I got to get there early. Like if I'm going to get back for a game, it's gotta be like now, you know, and, get up there. But I do want to get up there this year.
Might be pretty good
game. So it's gotta be soon. It's gotta be soon.
We've played a couple of real late fall games that was 72 degrees though. You know, we played Minnesota at night one year and it was like a heat wave.
That would have been nice.
Yeah.
That's a nice, like, nice night game, nice and warm.
Yeah. What do you think about that Kinnick environment nowadays?
It's crazy, man. Like coming in there, it's awesome. Like it's awesome. Like with the, the way it's designed is kind of crazy. I love like the new things they do with the hospital that like wasn't there when I was there is now up there. And then they wave at the kids. It's just, it's really exciting and electric. I took my now wife was my fiance back then actually. And she was just amazed at the energy. Like we were walking up past Slater Hall, coming up to the stadium and, you know, they got the guys, the band and the fans and, you know, they're just the whole environment. She's like, I've never seen anything like this. I'm like, just welcome to college football. Welcome to Big Ten. You know what I mean? Like,
welcome to Iowa.
Each college has that, like, you know, you go to Michigan or whatever. It's just kind of that energy, that vibe is just, it's just palpable, right? And it's just grown over time. Right. Like you got the guy who dresses up as now Connect and does the Connect speech, right? Like it's entertainment and fun, right? And even if you're not I took my kids, they couldn't follow the game, but they could follow the energy.
Yeah.
And it was a palpable part of it, right? Like I went to a game in Canada, college game in Canada. It was like nothing like it. Like it was just, like if you didn't know the person exactly, like you would never go for the fun of the game and et cetera. So it's a total experience, right? It's part of the experience. And I think it's been enhanced over time.
Yeah. Well, we want to be respectful of your time. You've already given us an hour. Fucking insane that you even did that for us. Thank you so much for joining the podcast today, man.
Thanks and for also, having thank me on, you man. For dropping absolute gems of information that I know a lot of our podcast listeners are going to like appreciate hearing. They're going to be like, wow, I need a mindset change in this area because I'm literally the human that the Bill's talking about right now.
Yeah. I mean, I hope so. I hope it helped people. I wish I listened to or heard, or there were podcasts or like slap me around, you know, I needed, you know, full cool coach. So I hope people get value out of it. And it's been great being on, you know, I'm happy to help out Hawkeyes.
Yeah, all right.
You're awesome to talk to you, man.
All right.
Thank you enough.
Episode 341. Thanks, listeners, for tuning in. We'll be back again on Monday. See you then. Peace.